everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. On this episode, we will be doing an in-depth analysis of Otto Preminger's film noir masterpiece, Laura. A 1944 classic that weaves a tale of mystery, romance, and intrigue as Detective Mark McPherson, played by Dana Andrews, investigates the murder of the beautiful and charming advertising executive, Laura Hunt, played by Jean Tierney. So, with all that being said, we hope you enjoy this wonderful episode punctuated by Stephen C. Smith's genius commentary, along with our recurring audience Q&A.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with all you guys to talk about Otto Preminger's Laura. Now, I realized in watching the picture this week that I had not seen it, I think, since the late 1970s. I got on to see many of Preminger's other films, his later films. He's a favorite of mine, and that he's a director who, in his cinematic world, nobody is completely innocent. Everybody's got their hands dirty in some ways or another. Ambiguity reigns, and cinematic fluidity with long takes, scenes with crowds, and memorable camera choreography is always present. Now, Andrew Saris, in his canonical book, The American Cinema, starts off his evaluation of Preminger, and he's a fan. He says, Laura is Preminger's Citizen Kane, in that Otto's detractors, like Orson's, have never permitted him to live it down. Well, I don't know if there's really many detractors of Preminger left at this point. He was a more controversial fellow, I think, in his days of his 40-year working career. He was tyrant on the set and apparently in his private life. But we're looking at the work here, and I think the work is still very solid. The analogy I was thinking with Laura this week was a film that it otherwise has nothing in common with, Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, but it essentially established the careers of both men, the successes of each of those films, and they went on to have long and very fruitful filmmaking careers after that. Another thing that Andrew Saris says that I like here is it follows logically that Preminger's films, more often than not, although they have a somber, solemn quality, is many melodramas at 20th Century Fox in particular, like Laura, Fallen Angel, Whirlpool, Where the Sidewalk Ends, Angel Face. Now, many of these may not be familiar titles to you, but I would recommend and I hope you'll be enthused and motivated to seek them out. And he says also beautifully, these are all moodily fluid studies in perverse psychology rather than simple crackling suspense movies. The characters click even as the action falters. Now, the gentleman who's going to join us here momentarily, Stephen Smith, has been on the program several times here in the past. He did a beautiful lecture focusing exclusively on Laura and its genesis. He was with us also for a discussion of composer Max Steiner. He's the author of a book on another great composer, Bernard Herrmann. So, Stephen, welcome back. And you're going to tell us about the genesis of Laura, a subject which, before we spoke earlier this week, I realized I knew very little about. And how Preminger sort of, well, as Andrew Saris says here, for his part, Preminger refuses to accept any responsibility whatsoever for the films he directed before Laura in 1944. I think you can go from there.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Gary. It's great to be back with you. And I hope that those watching were able to see my talk, so I'm not going to really repeat myself much. But I also wanted to credit, because as great and valuable as Andrew Saris's book is, I do think it slights the writers of films considerably. And I wanted to just reinforce the idea that it was Ruben Mamoulian who brought in two of the key Oscar-winning screenwriters for this film, and that Preminger is working from a very, very good script. And what I hope to talk about for just a few minutes today was the book that it's based on and its relationship to the film. Because when I grew up watching Laura, I just enjoyed it as a mystery with the film noir tropes I was falling in love with, and beautiful Jean Tierney showing up and great character actors. And then as I got older, I thought, what is really going on in this movie? Clearly, there's a lot of subtext here. Why is, you know, what is the Laura-Waldo relationship about? What is the Shelby and Trenbull relationship about? And so I read the book by Vera Caspari, which was begun, the idea supposedly came to her in 1940. It evolved into a Collier's Magazine serial published in 42, novel then simply called Laura in 1943. And that's when Fox optioned it to film, and it was released in 1944. And I think reading Vafbira Kaspari's book sheds some light on some of the interesting choices that everybody made on this movie. The screenwriters, especially Daryl Zanuck, gave very, very specific notes to the screenwriters about what he expected the characters to be. And those notes were carried out and were really critical to the final film. And then, yes, Preminger, who is, to me, Hal Wallace is the driving force behind Casablanca. He made all the key choices and made the rewrites and even chose on the final day of looping what was going to be the last sentence of the movie. And Preminger, if you have to choose one person, is the driving force of Laura. He met with Kaspari. He begged Zanuck to direct it. He was given the permission to produce it and then ultimately direct it when Mamoulian floundered for reasons that remain controversial. But Vincent Price talked about how Otto Preminger was ideal because he could bring out the evil behind the superficially likable supporting characters. And I thought, are they evil or are they, what exactly are they? And I will just say this, in the book, Waldo Leidecker is depicted as feminine in lots of ways, but not explicitly gay, which is something an author could have done in 1943 when the novel was published, but Vera Kaspari chose not to do. She depicts Waldo as a man who is asexual and a collector. And I think the first shot of the movie that Preminger gives us really, you know, sets up that idea of Waldo as a collector, and that fundamentally his relationship with Laura is about she's the ultimate collection, more than the clock and the vases and everything that he's got. In the book, when he cannot buy a vase that he wants at a store, he deliberately breaks it and shatters it when he hears someone else has bought it and says, oh, so sorry about that. You know, if he can't have something, he destroys it.
Steven, of course, Daryl Zanuck is kind of a hero on this program. We've featured many of his films and gotten into his MO quite a bit. But
yes,
for those of us who never heard of Vera Kaspari, like myself, can you give us a little background into her? Does she have any kind of following or appreciation at this point in mid?
She does. She's very relevant to the film because she was an ambitious woman at the dawn of the 20th century in the late teens or and 20s, and really pushed her way, but in the best possible way, no negative connotations on that, pushed her way into an advertising world that just wanted her to be a stenographer. And she wrote a number of books. And what people may not realize is that Hollywood made 24 films based on her stories, everything from Letter to Three Wives to Fritz Lang's The Blue Gardenia, to Gene Kelly and Les Girls.
That's one good film out of three, I would say, in that sense.
And she published a very successful autobiography. So during her lifetime, she had a following, but Laura was that credit. Unlike some people, though, where they're kind of cursed by a single title, she made the most of it. She wrote a play based on it. There were two TV adaptations. So Laura kept popping up in all these various iterations. It's done. Someone contacted me after the lecture and said that she had performed in the stage version at some local production. Forgive me for not recalling who that is. So yes, so in making Laura a working woman in the advertising world, that was unusual. And it, as I ended my lecture by quoting a scholar as saying, Laura, the character, is not a femme fatale. She is a working woman who's not punished by the author or the story, but who is coveted by these men who project things into her and want to control her and feel perhaps threatened by her autonomy. And that's something that the film retains, is her autonomy as a person. We're told about the different men that she dated. Now, I thought in reading the novel that we might get a more explicit background of her love affairs and the physical relationships that make Waldo so jealous. And I was disappointed to see that Kaspari really doesn't tell us anything about Laura's private romantic life that we don't get in the movie. It's kind of a name check of the previous men, including the painter.
Is the book still in print, Stephen?
It is still in print. It has remained. My understanding is it has remained in print. It's one of those titles like The Maltese Falcon that, you know, thanks no doubt to its film association, is just hangs on. So Waldo's a little different in the book. And I just wanted to mention one last thing about Waldo. There was a big fight between Vera Kaspari and Otto Preminger over how the character of Waldo was going to shoot the woman that he thinks is Laura. Of course, we know it's the hidden gun in the clock in the movie. That's an invention of the screenwriters. In the book, the cane that he's carrying around is in fact a gun. And Vera Kaspari told Preminger that he had to keep it as the cane because it symbolized Waldo's impotence. So he is an impotent collector in the book. Not that we're told that explicitly. And Otto Preminger either preferred the idea of the matching clocks or he was citing genuine research when he told her that he had researched the subject and there was no way that a cane could contain enough buckshot to destroy someone's face so thoroughly that she could not be recognized.
Yes, that's in a James Bond film.
Yes, exactly. And I do think that sounds about right to me. I think the clock device works very well. And the movie, of course, shows us the clock at the very beginning. Waldo asks for it twice, but he does it in the course of always saying, I want this, the clock, my vase. And it's always kind of a thrown away thing, but he certainly plants it well in the film.
So he started to explain to me the other day how Preminger was really in the doghouse at Fox before he started shooting this film.
Yeah, and put me in the camp that thinks that he deliberately sabotaged Mamoulian so that he could save the day. And you know what? He was a better director for it. His sort of objective quality, his ability to shoot things in those long, fluid, beautiful takes is exceptional. I do want to quote one thing. I knew David Raxon pretty well, the composer. I took his class first at USC, and he encouraged me to write my Bernard Herrmann book, which was really my first professional enterprise, and then we remained friends to the end of his life. And he loved to tell the story about his, let's say, disagreement with Preminger over a theme for Laura. In the book, Laura's favorite song is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. Vera Caspari tells us that not once but twice. Fox either didn't want that song or couldn't license it. And then Preminger wanted Summertime, and that couldn't be licensed. And then he was going to use Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Lady. And I'm going to quote from Foster Hirsch's autobiography of Preminger that has a fun quote from David. This sheds a sort of, let's say, a disappointing light on Preminger, because I believe David's right, but I'll quote this. He says, Otto told me he was going to use Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Lady as the theme song and work it around the original music that I would be composing. I told him it would be wrong for the movie. We argued. We both raised our voices. Nothing new there. He said the song would be right because, quote, Laura is a whore. I said, according to who? Where did you get this fellow? Otto asked Alfred Newman, the musical director. Al said to Otto, listen to Dave, David Raxon. So I find it very odd that Preminger gives Laura her due, and he was extremely supportive of Jean Tierney. I think that he sensed her fragility after the great shock of her very, very ill child that she had right before the film. But I was sorry to hear that was how Preminger characterized Laura, because I think the film really does show, as Vera Caspari intended, Laura as an independent woman who, although we may briefly consider her a suspect, is simply a very strong woman who, as far as we know, doesn't quit her job at the end of the movie, unlike almost every working woman that we see in films of the 1940s.
Mm-hmm. So was the film at or near the top grossers of 1944? Was it at that level of popularity?
I can say this. I know that the next year's top movie was the most profitable film Fox had had, and that was Jean Tierney and Leave Her to Heaven. That was a blockbuster. Boy. So Laura teed that up because up to this point, Jean Tierney was not a movie star. I mean, her biggest role was as Don Ameche's wife in Heaven Can Wait in 1943. You know, so she was making some good films, and she was the second choice for this film after Jennifer Jones, who Selznick wouldn't let do it. So I think it's really Preminger's direction. The fact that Tierney was the perfect person to play this rather enigmatic, remote woman. So the movie, by the time it was finished, Fox had very low expectations for it. And Zanuck famously stepped up in the screening room when the lights came up after watching it and said, well, we missed the boat on this one. And he walked out. Well, they didn't miss the boat. They made a fortune on it. It was very successful. Got 5 Oscar nominations, which was not at all expected. It won for cinematography, which was not at all expected. You know, this was conceived as a B-plus movie that became an A-minus movie that became one of people's favorite movies of 1944 in a year that also had Double Indemnity. But the impact also was so strong that when the 2 TV adaptations were done, when Tierney and Andrews and Vincent Price reteamed for a Lux Radio Theater version in 1945, I believe every single one uses the David Raxon theme because that is Laura, you know. So it was a movie that stuck with people. And again, at a time before television, at a time before certainly videotapes, when you could only see this movie when it came out, the fact that it lived in people's memories, you know, for so strongly, so that a decade plus later, they had to recreate so many aspects of the film, tells you how strongly it affected people.
In the whole context now of Preminger's career, it really strikes me that Dana Andrews seems to be sort of, across those decades of filmmaking, kind of a stand-in for Preminger in some ways. He was in this, he was in Fallen Angel, Daisy Kenyon, where the sidewalk ends, in harm's way many years later, another one of Preminger's best films, I think. To me, in some ways, he's almost like, is Robert De Niro to Scorsese or Elliot Gould to Robert Altman. He's seen bad things. He expects to see more bad things. He takes the fall. He's caught up in situations that sometimes he's in over his head. And he seems to be a real perfect match somehow for the material that Preminger's engaged with.
You're right on the money. And my last thing I'll say is that I think Dana Andrews is very easy to underrate in this film. And if you've read the book, you'll know that Mark McPherson is best known for this daring raid on a criminal that involved his getting shot, and he survived it. And there's a brief reference to this in the first talk with Waldo Leidecker, but it's emphasized much more in the book. And Mark is a damaged person. And I think that the way they give him something that is in the book, that funny little baseball, you know, toy to play with, The way he turns away and walks away from Waldo when asked if he ever knew a woman who wasn't a doll or a dame, the way Dana turns his back and plays it to the cameras, he says, a dame once got a fur coat, you know, for fox fur out of me.
In Washington Heights, still that.
In Washington Heights. I think he plays the subtext of the book's character so well, of somebody who is physically damaged. I think I see a limp in his performance too, just a little bit. And I think he drew some of that backstory to make Mark feel kind of like a damaged person, which is why, and this is something Zanuck emphasized in his notes, every single character had to be so, either in Mark's case, very hard-bitten and very tough because of what he'd seen in the world, or part of this backstabbing society world, that he said Laura comes into it and she's like a child at first. She's so pure. And you have to be struck by the purity of her coming into this world of kind of terrible people or damaged people. And I think that comes through.
How was the arc of Clifton Webb's career affected by this afterwards?
He went from having no career, in Hollywood at least, he was purely a stage actor who had never been in a talkie, to being a Best Supporting Actor nominee, to being the star of a Fox movie series, the Mr. Belvedere movies, to being the star with Barbara Stanwyck in their biggest 1953 movie, Titanic. For about a dozen years, he's box office. And this was someone that Zanuck flat out refused to even watch a screen test of, much less hire. Right. And again, Preminger, to his credit, just pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And finally, he got Webb to do a screen test and showed it to Zanuck. And as Preminger told it, Zanuck was such a professional that he watched it and said, you son of a bitch. All right, you can have him.
Now, I don't think I'm going to get out of my mind soon the sight of him, the way he sits in the bathtub there at least twice in the film, I think, right?
Yes.
There.
Yes.
And Vincent Price also kind of early in his career before he was typecast there, right?
Yes, before he's typecast. He's not the Shelby of the book exactly. That's, if you can imagine a weak Randolph Scott, which is tough because Randolph Scott is always so virile, but he's supposed to be tall and Southern and so charming that he's an easy seductress. Everything's great about him except his refusal to work and his tendency to leech off of everyone. And I think that Vincent Price is extremely good at playing the charm and the leechiness. And incidentally, the character of Anne Treadwell in the book, she has no real purpose. She has no real relationship with Shelby. She's Laura's aunt, and she's really just someone for Laura to talk to. So I think it was a good choice on the part of the screenwriters to give her a relationship with Shelby and to give her all of that tart dialogue that Judith Anderson plays, particularly in the wonderful single take scene with Laura in the powder room, where she says, Shelby's weak, he's right for me, you know, he's capable of murder because I know I'm capable of murder too. I didn't do it, but I thought of it. Or, yeah, all that great dialogue she has as she's looking away, powdering herself.
And so many 40s films, it also seems like there's a 6 degrees of Alfred Hitchcock somehow lingering around the corner.
Oh, no question. Mrs. Danvers is definitely like the shadow image of Judith Anderson and everything she played after 1940 in Rebecca. And again, I have to say, casting by Ruben Mamoulian in that case. So there were a few different cooks, you know, adding flavors into this movie. But no question, Preminger is the master chef who brings it all together and serves.
And the one picture that Hitchcock, I believe, made at 20th Century Fox, Lifeboat. Very accomplished, but was received very poorly, at least in its original movies.
Yeah. And Daryl Zanuck wanted John Hodiak, who had just done Lifeboat, to star in Laura.
Excellent in Lifeboat, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, we usually ask Dan Cahill to come in, and this being an Oscar winner for Best Cinematography, which I did not know until just now, he's got a lot to work with, I suspect.
I do. And I have to say, I'm joining both of you gentlemen in my admiration for Otto Preminger. which I was not born with. I acquired it over, say, the last 20 years as I've seen more and more of his films and admired what we are all praising is the fluidity of his camera style. And I will try to deal with that. But Preminger was probably a bad person, but a really good artist. I think we could say that. So one thing I want to note right at the beginning, it's unusual for the author of the source material to have his or her name on the opening title card. I guess she had a really good attorney or agent, but this is unusual for Vera to have her name right there with the title. As Stephen mentioned, the first shot we see in the film is of items that Waldo has collected. And I just want to point out, these are rather fragile, delicate-looking glass objects, the sort of thing that you might expect Waldo to have once you kind of get to know his personality. The camera then glides to the right, and we discover Dana Andrews as Mark McPherson, the police detective. And you can kind of see just from the way he holds himself, the way his hat rides on his head, he's a man's man. Mirrors are a big deal with Preminger, as they are with a lot of directors who like to move the camera. And moving the camera to a different position is in many ways a substitute for cutting to a different scene. You pan over to something, and this reframes the scene in a different way. Venetian blinds. God, you can't talk about any film noir without noticing the Venetian blinds, which kind of go a little crazy in some of these scenes. They're kind of cute, but I think now people would maybe limit their use a little bit more. And of course, I'm of the generation that grew up with Vincent Price in Roger Corman horror films, and it's nice to see there was a lot more to him.
Oh, yes.
And this is something that we don't see his straight acting career prior to the late 50s, I guess. So it was refreshing to see him in a sort of serious role.
You just reminded me of the old question of who would you invite to a dinner party? Vincent Price and Roddy McDowall were the two. I'd pick either or, probably Vincent Price, because I love his performances. But those two men watched what was going on. And in their interviews, like Price talking about the making of Laura, he has so much insight into things that were happening with a lot of compassion, but sharpness. And many of the best accounts of what's going on behind the scenes come from Vincent Price. So I just wanted to say that was another of his qualities, was a very strong ability to be an observer while performing.
It's also interesting to see him in, say, 2 and 3 shots dominating the scene with his height.
Yes.
I mean, he was like 6'4 or 5, kind of up there with Christopher Lee and Rock Hudson and Jimmy Stewart. It would have been interesting to cast those three guys side by side, how they looked, but those days are over.
And Fox clearly liked the pairing of him and Jean Tierney because he is her fiance in Leave Her to Heaven, in Act One at least. And then they were paired in a movie called Dragon Wick that doesn't quite come off, in my opinion, but it's certainly worth seeing.
Yeah.
Well, that was his first film. Yeah, kind of a mixed bag, as I recall.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It was entertaining. And
they knew how to entertain.
Yes. Yes. God bless them.
Studio. Yes.
Well, it's a studio with a great history. Of course, it's now, from the perspective of film distribution and exhibition, it's owned by the Disney Company. But in our theater, we'll give them some credit because they have supplied very good DCP quality copies of films. Well, Laurie, do we have any people out there who want to comment or question us?
We sure do. Marjorie, could you unmute your audio and start your video?
Hi, thank you. I saw this yesterday after many, many years, and I really did notice a lot that I had not seen before. I'm usually a dark shadow and light person, and this really didn't have that much, but I really enjoyed the difference of wide angle shots where there are many people all in focus, everything going on, and also a lot of the worm's eye view where the camera is, you know, looking up at the person. So I thought it had a very good variety of camera angles in it, and especially the beginning shot. It just seems like it's all in one when they're just looking all over her apartment. So I really enjoyed that very much.
Thank you, Marjorie.
May I just make a comment on that? When these films were released, particularly the ones that Daryl Zanuck produced just after the war, the series that we think of as now noir, like Kiss of Death and The House on Telegraph Hill and all of those, often they weren't even called crime films. The French had come up with the phrase film noir in, I believe, 1946, but that wasn't used in America at the time. You will see over and over in the reviews of these movies them being called as documentary style. And I think it's because there is a greater quality of realism to the both the characterizations and what you were referring to, Marjorie, is the absence of extreme noir lighting. The Fox films tend not to have that same kind of German expressionist style. I mean, Leave Her to Heaven, which is certainly a noir movie, is in gorgeous Technicolor and has a realistic look of its own. So in the day, it's fascinating that the films were often called documentary style.
Which it is, and it was done really beautifully. Thank you.
We have some strange guy raises in the Max Alvarez.
Who's that?
Who's that Max Alvarez guy?
He must be out in the field today.
I need to stay away as a participant from these talkbacks more regularly because you guys are a fantastic trio, all of you contributing brilliantly. And this has been such a pleasure to observe from the audience perspective.
Thank you.
Take on Laura.
Well, we model ourselves after you, of course.
Yes, and we're the Four Musketeers, really.
Oh, you must stop, please. I can't. Take no, this is just wonderful. What are your thoughts on this? I don't know whether this is not a criticism or praise one way or the other. Laura is an unusually talking noir. It is very, 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 very dialogue intensive. Stephen, you've read the novel. Is the novel very much that way as well? What are your thoughts on the dialogue intensity of Laura?
I agree with you, Max. When I grew up, I always thought, gee, there's virtually no action. There aren't fights in this movie. You know, the only sequence without dialogue is a guy walking around an apartment drinking and going through the undergarments of a dead woman. But then I read the novel, and suddenly the film seems so laconic and spare because the novel is, for a modern reader, for me at least, it's overwritten. And Vera Caspari, and look, it's been in print for 80 years, so, you know, she obviously did the right thing. But she modeled her approach after the Wilkie Collins mystery novel, one of the first ever written, The Woman in White, in that she has the characters take turns telling the story. So the first quarter of the book is told by Waldo, and Waldo is great when he's throwing out his snappy lines, but reading, you know, 40 pages of him talking in that style, I was just ready to stop reading. It's just too much. It's too florid, you know? And then Mark takes over the story rather logically, and we get his perspective. And then when Laura comes into the story, we get Laura's perspective. And that's when I was really hoping that we'd get a whole different take on her than, you know, a richer one than we even get in the movie. And it's really not much more than that. So I agree with you, Max. It is a very dialogue-driven movie, but I think that what interested Preminger were the characters, and it's not so much how the characters act as to what they're not doing and what they say contradicts what they're feeling. So it doesn't really bother me, but I agree with you 100%. It may be the most dialogue-driven noir classic of them all.
And I could just add, as I was thinking about preparing my segment on the look of the film, for a little while, I was just kind of going, whoa, wait a minute. There's no fight in here. There's one action scene, the very last scene.
Last 3 minutes.
Yeah. But then I buckled down and realized how much fluidity there is in the film. And as I've said and will continue to say forever, Preminger was one of the masters of the moving camera. And I think that helps liven it up visually quite a bit.
And they were wise to keep it under 90 minutes because it's, yeah, what, 88 minutes, something like that.
And weren't there some different versions of Laura? Didn't they cut the picture slightly for some versions?
Yes. There was one big cut, and it amazes me that they did it. That great montage, when it's during the first flashback when Waldo has taken Mark out to dinner and he's talking about his kind of grooming, if you will, of Laura and taking her to meet all the right people. And it's the Gene Tierney glamour montage. And it's what you always see clipped from the movie if people are going to show. It's one of the most excerpted montages. And what I have read was that Zanuck decided that during the war, that kind of wallowing in luxury and expensive things and glamorous parties and coming out of opening nights was in bad taste. And for whatever reason, that section of the flashback was initially omitted and then restored. So I think it was a mistake. I think that people during that time liked to see people like Gene Tierney in beautiful clothes in beautiful places. And indeed, you will find there's this original version and extended version, and you want the extended version because it's the real version. It's the one that has that montage in it.
We have someone else with a question. Grace?
I was wondering, in Trumbo, Bryan Cranston is seen in the bathtub typing. Was Trumbo paying homage to this movie?
The real Dalton Trumbo was famous for writing in the bathtub, and there are pictures of him sitting there with that little typewriter set up doing that. So I love that you pointed that out, Grace. I think it's just a fun coincidence because, if anything, I don't think that the writers of Laura would have been making a private in-joke about Dalton Trumbo at the time. That would be the only thing. But Dalton Trumbo loved to write in the bathtub. Max Sennett supposedly got his best ideas in the bathtub. So there's a whole other talk back for someday, you know, the creativity in the bathtub.
This discussion was facilitated by resident film curator Gary Palmucci and cinematography expert Dan Cahill. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making this podcast possible. This episode was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and take care.